This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world. This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at factors that will shape our food world in 2019. We start with trend predictions and how media covers them.
A website could theoretically devote all their coverage to these viral trends and get all sorts of hits. That's not a way to build sustainable readerships, just as it's not a way to build, sustainable restaurants.
We report on a big change coming and how street meat will be served.
On January 1st, a ban on plastic foam went into effect in New York City.
And we round out the episode with a story about using gene editing to create the spicy tomato of the future.
At first, it sounds like a gimmick or like something that you would do for fun. The truth is, there is a real value behind it.
It's not too late to make your resolution. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode this year.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. This week, Greg is over in London's East End, sitting down with sommelier and restaurateur Charlie Mellor. He's the owner of The Laughing Heart, a contemporary restaurant that specializes in one of our favorites, natural wines. Charlie has one of the more interesting backgrounds that we've ever come across in someone who runs a restaurant. He is a former professional opera singer who made his debut in native Australia. We are also at the Dangerbird Records studio to hear one hell of a live performance from the Pantheons, a post-punk quartet coming out of LA's South Central. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I'm sitting in the cave, or the cave, if you will, the Laughing Heart in Shoreditch.
Yeah, just outside Shoreditch on Hackney Road.
Yes, yeah. And that voice is Charlie Mellor. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hi there.
We met on Monday, but we have many mutual friends, and it's such a pleasure. It was such a wonderful meal. How many of those collaboration dinners did you do with Com from Paris?
That was just the one.
Just the
one. It was
one
off that we had Issa for one night. It was really fantastic. Yeah.
Look, before we get into this amazing, amazing place, let's go back.
Cool.
Before wine, before that, when you sang your first note, because you trained as an opera singer, and I've always wondered, because I've never gotten a chance to speak to one, when did you realize that you had a voice for opera?
You know, I think it's probably different for everyone. For me, it happened quite quickly. Like, I decided to start pursuing sort of considered vocal study as a hobby just after I finished high school.
Okay.
It was something, I'd always been a musician. I was a jazz trombonist, and I was really interested in, you know, continuing to sort of, you know, explore music after school. And, you know, when it used to do the school musical and all that kind of stuff, I had a bit of fun. I knew that I could carry a tune, and I knew that I liked it. But the first time I had a lesson, I had a teacher say, have you been to the opera? And I said, no. She said, look, you should go, and you should, you know, see if this is something that's interesting for you, because if you wanted, this could be, you know, this could be work for you. And, well, it was less than 12 months later, I think I made my professional debut. It was a pretty quick transition for me.
Do you remember that teacher's name?
Yeah, I certainly do. A very beautiful woman called Janice Lang.
I mean, you have to wonder, like, what do teachers see? Like, that's when teachers are at their best. I mean, we've talked about in the show, it's like they have all these experience, they have all these students come through, and they say, you know what, jazz trombonist, I think you could be the very brilliant career of an opera singer. Have you ever gone back and asked her, like, what did you see?
I don't know that I directly have, no. But, I mean, it's a very small town in, you know, well, Perth, Western Australia. It's the most isolated city in the world. I don't know that necessarily the standard of, you know, was as high there as it is in some parts of the world. I think that she probably just enjoyed the fact that she had discovered someone whose voice was naturally suited and has a physiology and a sound imagination, if you like, to kind of get into that space and make those kind of noises.
Sound imagination is a very specific term for opera. I'm describing when you began to like look at your voice in a more critical way. What did you discover, and what did you have to build to get to the soloist career that you had?
Well, I mean, I think that the one of the very beautiful things about the classical vocal production is that it is inherently designed to not just be beautiful, but to also be as efficient as possible. I mean, one of the ways in which when you're making the most beautiful noises, it's very often hand in hand with the healthiest vocal production, which will give you the stamina and to interpret the great roles. And I think that the pedagogy of vocal practice is about understanding how to achieve that as regularly as possible, and how to access it from challenging moments within, you know, vocal pressure or stress, and have it become a technique that you can turn into a craft.
What was the first part or piece or aria or song or snippet that you felt that you mastered?
Ooh, well, I don't know that I ever did master anything, and I guess, as we all know, this maybe is an idea we never would. But there might have been a few Italian art songs, most of the sort of late Romantic sort of era, kind of in the late 19th, early 20th century, from around Naples and that part of Italy, that helped me discover a resonance in my voice, if you like. There's certainly pieces of German Lieder, which are often associated with quite light voices, which I definitely wasn't, that helped me find a healthiness and freshness in my voice as well. You know, there's a few penny drop pieces that I felt, you know what, I performed that really seamlessly, and in the process of doing that, learned a lot.
2008, you moved to the UK.
That's right.
And you started working at the Guildhall School of Music, but you also was working away as a somm. When did you pick up your love of wine, and how did you discover, where did wine enter the story?
Wine entered the story for me around the same time that music became a serious consideration and interest. When I was a teenager, like I say, when I was playing music and all these type of things, I remember being offered the opportunity when I was a young guy to try a glass of a 1991 Trimbach Riesling Grand Cru, not the closest to, and something with no residual sugar. And all of my, you know, my father's mates were big manning it around this bottle of wine and talking about how grassy it was and everything, and I was very lucky just to have a look in at the tender age of 15 or something. And I remember putting my nose to the glass and feeling this very sort of notable sensation of almost being like in suspended animation and being lost in wine for the very first time and listening in the great distance to these guys waffling on about grassy notes and this and that, and I distinctly remember coming and saying to myself, this is fresh deal that I'm smelling right here.
To pull from a friend, non-donkey's ass.
No. There was no donkey's ass in that wine. No donkey's ass in that wine, although I'm sure that there's a context under which donkey's ass could be pretty delicious as well. But
Magnus.
Particular wine, was pure as the driven snow. But I remember just having that connection, felt like a lightning bolt to the head of some sort of neural pathway, and it was very, very meaningful. And so I started enjoying wine at a really young age. I started enjoying gastronomy at a young age, and when my first job out of high school, when I was studying at university, was as a waiter in a restaurant, and became a sommelier by the time I was 18, and was just sort of doing these things in and around. It was just pursuing my interests.
Did you see the connection between the two? I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in the show about the intangible values of being a musician or being a cook or being involved in food or creating a song, but at that age, did opera seem like one track and being a psalm seem like one track and you didn't really, or did you see more crossover?
No, I think they probably did feel a bit separate. Like I like to think that I was a deeply engaged, connected young person who had the profound ideas about the golden thread that runs through life, whatever. And I'm sure that I will continue to form those ideas for the rest of my life. But when I was 18, I think I just loved making music and I loved hanging out in restaurants and moving fast and slinging plates, selling wines. And I don't think I saw as many parallels between them as I do now. I think it was probably when I made the decision to sort of transition away from music for a while that I started, maybe out of necessity, to draw more meaning from the work that I was doing with wine and certainly form some quite real connections and see now how there's a lot of similarities, actually.
I want to get to that in a second, but I want to finish your career. 2011, you go to Houston.
That's right, yeah.
And then you travel around the world and you're a freelance opera soloist.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And what is the distinction of that besides being in like a part of a company, or how is it varied?
There's a million different ways to crack that nut, you know, and it really just depends on what opportunities are available to you as an individual and what's suitable for you. There's a million factors that could inform the decision, bureaucracy being one of them, you know, your personal situation. But for me, I was given the opportunity to anchor myself in one country, working for one company predominantly, but then also have a little bit of time exploring, you know, projects in other cities, was a really exciting way to get into the biz. And it was certainly a pretty enviable way to start. Yeah.
And what is it? Do you get like an email or a phone call? It's like, we have an ARIA emergency.
Sometimes you do, yeah. And most of the scheduling for classical music is done years in advance. You sort of know what you're going to be doing in, you know, 2 or 3 years' time, and if you're lucky, even, you know, further in advance, which can give you time to make, you know, strategic choices about how to learn things, how to prepare for roles, how to make personal time in your life in and around it, etc. But I mean, when you're young and you're scrapping with everyone to see what you can get, and someone phones you and says, you know, are you able to, at the drop of a hat, be somewhere in 36 hours and perform something? If it's in your body and your head, why not?
Can you tell, almost like a wine that's had enough time to age, can you actually hear someone perform when they're performing opera and be like, they've actually prepared years for this wall? Can you tell when they've had more time to prepare?
Yeah, well, I would say generally yes, you can, because it's such a detailed and involved process to prepare one of the great roles, you know, sort of a Tristan or an Otello or something like that, that's sort of is a tour de force in terms of the physical stamina that's required. And, you know, in order to interpret it beautifully and actually bring something of your own humanity to a very established work of art, I think that it's theoretically possible to breeze through it in one way, but you'll never have the nuance and the detail. And so I think that the great interpretations probably almost always come from a lot of preparation. Yeah.
Okay, same question, both fields.
Okay.
How many times do you need to sing a piece to feel like you've really gotten it? To the ability that you can say that I've got it, knowing that no one ever attains perfection. And how many bottles of wine did you feel that you had to taste before you were like, okay, I can really feel very, very secure in my tasting as a song? Considering the fact that you're always learning.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I'd say that as much as how many times you might perform or how many bottles you might open, I think it's about the time you put into it. So I definitely believe in that 10,000 hours thing. You know, like, I mean, I'm a huge believer in the fact that it just does take immersion and dedication to something, sometimes a really considered way and a really productive way, sometimes in a wildly unproductive way, you know, but to actually spend your time engaged, you know, with the process will actually help you, you know, come as close to mastering it as you might. And I don't know, I've spent tens of thousands of hours working on certain registers in my voice, and I've spent tens of thousands of hours polishing fucking glasses, and I've spent tens of thousands of hours drinking Beaujolais, and it's just something that it's more a question of time, I think.
2013, you take a sabbatical.
Yeah.
What leads to that decision, and what takes you back on the path to being into wine full time?
I was thinking about this, trying to organize my thoughts about it today, actually. I mean, it was a mixture of things. I mean, I was a little disenfranchised with the music industry that I was in rather than the practice itself. I think that for a lot of people it can be really wonderful and really rewarding, but I found it very tough, and I was pretty young to be doing the work that I was doing. And I don't necessarily think that whilst the opportunities were there, some of the support that was probably going to be essential to making it successful was coming along with it. And so I found myself feeling a little out of my depth, you know, and decided I needed to take a bit of a break. I had a death in the family at the exact same time that I was making that decision. And I think that you know, life just hits you sometimes. And then all of a sudden you find yourself doing different things. I knew that I needed an escape from that kind of work for a period of time. And returning to wine made perfect sense, because it's not just something that I enjoy and knew what I was doing, but it's something that I felt like I could really thrive and relish my time at work. It certainly requires discipline and requires a lot of you to be engaged emotionally, but in a different way, I think. And so it seemed like a good transition. And obviously it was a comfortable fit, because that was, you know, coming up on, well, 5.5 years ago now. I now own a restaurant and a wine shop, so and I haven't performed in 5 years, so, you know.
It's just a pause.
Yeah.
It's just we're going to get you just a couple more bottles of Merlot, and we'll get you up on the tables. The Laughing Heart, where we are, just past its two-year mark. What was the intention, and what was missing in the London wine scene that led you to open this place?
Well, look, the intention for me with this place, there were many, but one of the things that I wanted to enjoy was the opportunity to be creative in an entirely new way. I mean, you know, I'm very, very comfortable and experienced working on the floor, and have done that for a lot of other people and enjoy doing that, making their businesses run well and all that kind of thing. But I wanted that opportunity for myself, but I also wanted to design the place from the ground up, build as much as I possibly could, curate the whole experience and sort of evolve the way I was working. The only way to do that is to take the risk of opening your own place. And so that was the sort of one of the original intentions of it. And what I also had gleaned from my time working in the London restaurant scene was that there was a lot of fantastic things happening in East London. There's a lot of people who work in the business who gravitate towards this neighborhood. There's a really fantastic audience. Receptions for the kind of products we like is great. But there was a type of cuisine that I think is very suitable to the pairing with the kind of wines that I'm interested in that hadn't been explored as much. And I also think that people need a place to go late at night, man. You know, like, it's so hard in London. There's just nothing cool. And so when I found a building with a 2 a.m. license, it felt like a real opportunity.
And how does that, for us from America, how does that work? How does, like, you have to grandfather it in, or how does the building get licensed?
It's inherited. So the premises licenses in this country are assigned through the local municipal city bodies, the councils, and are tied to the building rather than to an individual. And so there are some buildings that, through good luck or, you know, some intelligent planning a long time ago, have some really fantastic premises licenses. I mean, this place, we can trade until 2 in the morning and serve booze. We also have an off license, so we can sell wine to take away. These are things that are quite unique properties for a restaurant space. And it felt like the thing to explore, because it's one of the essential components to this particular building. You know, it's
like we would be upset if we came in here and we knew it could be open until 2 and it closed at 12.
Sure.
People would be, why? Like, what are you doing? Yeah. Please do a pop-up. Please do anything. So you knew from there that, and so what, so when, well, to touch on the cuisine, what was the cuisine that was, you felt would be well paired with this that you did not see was being served out there?
It's a lot of the stuff that sort of, I was inspired by when I was working in Australia. Things with an Asian influence and just sort of a slightly more kind of irreverent thing. I mean, so much of the really fantastic gastronomy that's tied into kind of natural wine restaurants in London is pinned to the fantastic legacy and dynasty of someone like Ed Wilson that's centered around terrines and ostensibly classical continental food. And I think that that's highly appropriate. I think it's delicious and I'm a huge, huge advocate for it. But why not fuck with some Asian flavors as well? And, you know, but the thing about some of these wines, the way they smell and taste, for a lot of people, there's no reference point. So why not try to explore food and change the reference point there as well and see where they intersect? I mean, fundamentally, tasty is what we do here. Like, I don't, there's nothing weird about the cooking, but it's sort of not unusual to eat a very authentic regional pasta dish from Italy and have like a sort of some sort of Vietnamese salad on the same menu at our restaurant, and it does work well in sequence, and it works well with the wine, and it's reflective of the kind of contemporary gastronomy of London and the diversity that we have here. So
it's really interesting. So if they don't have a reference point for the wine, why tie it to a reference point that they might have for food? Because they might not understand the wine, or it might take away from them unlocking the different
totally
flavors and notes of the wine.
And I think that there are so many ingredients within restaurants that are often overlooked nowadays. I mean, restaurants are romantic places that are made up of so many moving parts. I think that the design of the space, the way it functions, the way it flows, the service details, the wine you serve, I think this is all as important an ingredient into making a complete experience as what is coming out of the kitchen. And so, I don't know, I wanted to break the wheel a little bit. I not for the sake of it, but because it felt like the right thing to do, and it still does very much.
We're going to take a quick musical break.
Cool, dude.
And we'll be back here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake Man are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
You and I spoke about before the similarities between the analysis and the undressing of a wine and the formation of sounds as a singer. I really want people to understand that because it's something we've touched on over the years here, but you are literally the embodiment of this manifestation of someone, because rock bands are fine. We've had people who are in rock bands and that's three chords, and no offense, that's amazing. But the complexities of opera, the understanding of opera, you can't just casually be like, oh, I'm going to sing an opera tomorrow or pick up, although you can if you have the training, as you said. And the same thing about wine. You can drink wine and drink it casually, but to really understand it, that 10,000 hours. So now that you're not 18 and now that you have chance to see the golden thread, as
I'm
you
very said, wise now.
Now yeah. that now at the wise age of 32, that you've had time to think about it, and I'm sure with your musician friends, you've gone long into the night about discussion. What have you found?
Well, I think it is interesting that, you know, I did start to see so many more parallels between these worlds and how to interpret them as I've become older. And I think that word interpreting is very, very important. I think that the one key similarity to being a sommelier and to being a singer, a classical singer, is that, I mean, I'm not the songwriter and I'm not the winemaker. I'm an interpreter of somebody else's material, you know, like I think that what it ultimately comes down to is that the fundamental core between the work of making music and the work of sharing these wines is the story, right? And what is it that you're doing to tell it and to tell it well? And I think that there are ways that you might think about the formation of sound that are not dissimilar to the ways that you might think about the technical analysis of a wine. I mean, for me, I found that huge.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot about sound and aroma in a complex mixture of geometric shapes and colors and things that I can touch and I can grab and I can move.
It's like synesthesia.
I think I quite acutely experienced that when I was into my teens. I actually feel like I fucking saw these things, and now it's more of an imagination of those ideas. But you know, for example, you know, I might be able to say to myself that I felt like the color of my voice needed a redness to it that has a black you can't get from blue, you know, the way that I might achieve that is by shifting shifting the sphere, 45 degrees around or something, and that sort of. When you can see, you know, when you put your nose into a glass, and those shapes might appear. You're not making them; they're being made for you. But you get to interpret them, and you get to analyze them, and you might help you to understand what happened to this wine with the passing of time, whether it be just airing in a decanter or in the glass or aging in a bottle for another decade. You know, it's the flow of it all starts to take shape.
So you'll taste a wine. When we were here on Monday, you mentioned like you're leaving a bottle in the corner because it needs more time.
Yeah.
It doesn't need more red or black or more. It's a triangle, but it needs to be like an octagon. Is that how you see it?
Sometimes, yeah. It's like or that black might become a bit more translucent, you know, over time. It's sort of there's lots of different ways, or that it might just start. The way that I want it to go, or the way that I suspect that it might transition is going to make me feel a certain way as well. You know, it's not always color or shapes. It's about sort of emotional states as well, and being able to kind of access those and then also articulate what you're accessing for yourself in the first instance, but then for whoever you're describing it to.
Have you ever been with a winemaker who asks for your advice or asks your opinion to describe something, and it just transports you back to being back in the classroom? Have you heard any like education or wording in the way that people will be able to move the process forward that is similar to the way that people talk about advancing musicians?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that Absolutely, and thankfully, in not just those disciplines, you meet people in regular life who, the discussion of any subject can be quite inspiring educators. And so, whilst it mightn't be as like sort of transportative to some sort of classroom experience, I definitely have had engaging conversations with people in my life that you feel like they not only do they know what they're talking about, but they know how to talk about what they're talking about. They know how to like. I would love to just spend my entire life surrounded by people like that. That would be amazing, you know. And I would love to be someone like that one day, you know. Like that's it's an amazing idea, something to aspire to. Yeah.
One of the great things about talking to you is that you are front of house owner, which used to be how it was up until I'd say the 70s when the chef came out and the rise of the chef owner. It's a performance.
Absolutely. And this is another kind of sort of comparison, if you would like to draw, between the worlds of being a performer on the stage and a performer on the floor. It's a different kind of performance. You need to be prepared in both. But when you actually eat a la minute in the restaurant floor, it's much more improvisational, right? Because the variables coming from the beautiful guests who you're there to take care of. And so you're responding to what they're bringing, and what they're bringing, you have no idea. You've got to assess that quite quickly. And I relish the interaction with every person, because it's sort of, you know, not only who are you, but who are you today? Like, what is what you're in the mood for? How do we thread the needle with you? And what element of my performance do I need to give? What authentic version of myself do I need to be to make sure that happens?
What are some of the flourishes or the trills that you will throw onto a nightly performance?
Wow. I mean, they're often quite interior things, because I think that it needs to happen table to table to table. I think that everyone's experience needs to be a little bit different generally. And so they're often quite subtle. But I mean, look, it can be as simple as knowing when to flirt, when not to flirt, when to, you know, make the table feel very in by telling them about the joint you smoked last night or something like that, or swearing, or, you know, like there's a million different ways that you can be yourself that can help people feel like they're getting something ready for them as well.
What is played in the restaurant?
It's an eclectic mix. It's pretty hilarious, actually, because I'm pretty strict with the music. I curate the
no surprise.
Yeah, because you know it's an important ingredient, and it might be a little bit repetitive for the staff, but you know what, the music that plays here gets a lot of compliments. It's a lot of old school hip hop, mostly East Coast stuff. There's a lot of artists that I love and who I might have met and been inspired by over the years. So we have people like Ed Motta on the playlist, and you know, Mad Lib, and like other people who love wine and, you know, like sort of into it as well. There's a lot of funk. It's music that makes people feel cool is the most essential thing. There's things that are nostalgic for me, because I often find that transported to a happy place can have a positive impact on the dynamic of the floor as well. So, I mean, it is hilariously controversial at the laughing heart, but I've explained to everyone is that...
Why controversial?
Because, the beautiful people who work for me might want to, you know, sort of have some involvement from time to time, but it's like, that's not how it works here.
I would say I'm sorry, but I'm not.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I'm brazenly unapologetic about the, you know, kind of 3.5-4 hours of music that plays on a loop, and I add to it when I can. But you know what, it works, and it's a functional tool as well, as much as anything. And so if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I personally still derive a great deal of pleasure out of every song.
How is it a functional tool for you?
Well, it's a functional tool in the respect that it sets an ambience. It's not exclusively responsible for it, but it's an ingredient that can help create an atmosphere in a room. It's one of the things that tells a story. It's like the lights. It's like the art on the walls. It's like the dishes or the wine or, you know, the server. I mean, it's a theatre, this whole thing, right? And it's just part of your set piece, you know.
Charles, thank you for making time for me today. Where can people find you? How can they visit you? What are the hours, one more time, for the people who are now that know?
Everyone who is keen should definitely come visit us at the Laughing Heart. We're open Monday to Saturday. The kitchen and bar open at 6:30 p.m. and we're open until 2 in the morning. We serve food until 1. We also have a wine shop in the basement, the car, where we're sat right now. And that is open from 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. 6 days a week. So come and see us.
The fact that you can get an incredible bottle of wine at like 155, 6 days a week is...
Totally.
I mean, we can't even get that in America.
Yeah, that's it. It's a growing part of what we're doing, and I think it's an exciting part of our unique offering. Yeah.
Okay, see you at 155 tonight.
Sweet, dude.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacking Tunes.
Enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. Every week, I answer listeners' questions on the latest innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients in the food world. Have a question about hot rodding your oven to make great pizza? Give us a call. Hydrocolloid, sous vide, liquid nitrogen, no problem. You can find cooking issues wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, coming from the legendary Dangerbird Record Studio in Silver Lake. We are here with the Pantheons, Xavier, Sebastian, Omar, and Gary. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
What's up?
Hey, what's going on?
So most people know Compton as a place for hip-hop and that music scene from the 90s, but there's a whole new music scene coming out of it, which you guys are a part of. For those unfamiliar with that music scene, can you tell people about what's going on in the backyards of Compton these days?
Well, who wants to start off? Who wants to go?
I'll kick it off.
Pauly?
Yeah, well, we started playing backyards like about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Well, we've all been playing the backyard scene for years, since we were kids, because that's the cool thing about backyard shows and the punk scene in Compton and South Central, Downey, Long Beach, all those areas, is that, you know, all you need is, like, a couple buddies, and, you know, they don't even have to know how to play as long as they just show up, you know, and we've just been playing since we were, like, 12, 14, you know, so, like, the scene in Compton right now, like, everything's punk, ska, psychobilly, and metal. And what we're doing, it's something different, like throwing in like elements of like goth and dark wave and stuff. So that's what we're doing.
And it's a cohesive scene, right? It's not just like a band here, a band there. Like there really is a good community vibe there.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. We got like a lot of up and coming bands, you know, that we play with. NNN, Freedom Curse, Diversity, Nocturnals, you know, like we all play shows together, like, you know.
And how did you individually find yourselves?
And the Neurotics? No, sorry.
No, shout out. We're big shout on shout outs here. But how did you guys find your way into the scene? What drew you to it? Did you come in as fans first, or did you start a band and that's how you made your way
fans,
in?
Fans, I think fans of music, really.
Definitely.
Yeah. Whatever was playing on the radio at the time.
Yeah. So. And is it fun to, like, come in as a fan, start your own band, and play with the guys that you were fans of?
Oh, hell yeah, man.
I think the best part is, like, reading the music and, like, just... Because you guys hang out. Like, I think once you become a band, you become family. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of seeing each other
on the
day.
It's like a second marriage.
It is. Like, people don't realize stuff that's going on internal until you're inside the band.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize everything. But the good thing, you get to kind of... It's like a family member. You have to take everything, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a good place to have another place to go, right?
Yeah, like, it is. You need that breather. Like.
Yeah.
I mean, how has it all been important for you to have this community and this scene that's really your own, and not having to, you know, come to downtown or come over to, like, Silver Lake?
Yeah,
like, what's like to grow something out of your own home?
It's awesome. Well, we had a show yesterday, which is actually...
Was it your house, right?
Yeah, it was exactly right in my house. That's the first, you know, it's cool, you know? Because, you know, we don't have to rent out a venue. We don't have to, you know, worry about any of that stuff. It's just if someone has a backyard and they're like, hey, I want to do a show here. Boom, we set up a date and that's it. If it gets rated, it gets rated. But, like, we don't, you know, we're, like, super DIY. Like, we're, like if we want to do something, we do it then and there. We don't rent out clubs or any of that
stuff. I mean, we don't
stuff.
Mind playing clubs either.
Yeah, we don't mind it.
Hey, just for the record, we're available for booking. We're available for a green room.
Yeah.
So. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Pantheons, how did you guys get started? Tell us a little bit about the band.
Well, Paul started the band.
When did the band start, Paul?
Yeah. Well, we started officially as a band because, you know, like, you know, at first you come up with like a thing.
Yeah.
And you're just like dudes jamming out. You don't,
like,
even have your
real?
Own sound.
It's not real. Yeah. Like, this is a thing.
Mad members coming in and out. But officially, I would say January 2017. Where I toured with these two guys. We went to this random tour in San Francisco, like January 2017, that's when we came out with our first EP as well, last year. And that's when we officially began. I just wanted to do something different, you know, because we've been part of the scene since forever, and, you know.
Right, because the scene is, like, you know, is mostly punk, and what you were saying before, but you guys do have this goth element to it, which is a little bit, which is funny because that's sort of how the history of punk was. Like, punk was like one thing, and then as it went on, it started to bring in these different elements and evolve.
And it turns into goth.
It turns into goth.
We're trying to bring that back, you know, because people forget that, you know, goth, you know, squirrels and chipmunks are goth to punk, you know. Goth is punk. That's where it came from.
Yeah,
how do people react to that? I mean, it is a unified scene, but when you start to do something different, sometimes people get a little eyebrows raised.
You're gonna have those people that are gonna end up jumping off your ship and stuff and enjoying something else, or you're not cool with it. But
we were doing the gigs, remember, first, and then it was weird. Like, people didn't accept it, like, when we were first playing, and that's when I think we started like we should do our own gigs because people weren't.
Yeah,
they weren't responding, right, Paul?
Yeah, like, yeah, they were responding. You know, like, yeah, because you know they didn't know whether to pit to it or skank to it or what to do to it.
They didn't know what to do. So yeah. I was like, nah, I'd rather not. Not
yeah, sometimes you got to show people what to do with their hands in a new situation. But then they figure it out that it's all come from the same place, right?
Yeah, but I think like because the new wave of punks now are like way more accepting of like what we're doing. Yeah, so like they dance, they do whatever the heck they want, and we condone it.
Awesome. Well, let's hear a song. Let's hear it. What are you going to play for us first?
All right. This next one is called Motel. It's a new one. We're going to play some new ones today.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we got Motel by the Pantheons here on Snacky Tunes at Danger Bird on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome back. That hey, ripped.
How's it going? Whew.
I do like the sound. I do like the vibe. You know, L.A. has a long tradition of punk. Yeah. Germs, XCC, yeah. Axe, things like that. And I know that, Gary, you're talking about Misfits, which is not exactly L.A.
No, but,
you know, it's like the L.A. scene, like everything, everyone from New York, you know, Sex Pistols made it out here. So what from, like, the original punk scene, like, what are you pulling from, if both musically and then aesthetically, like, what's your approach to your music? What did you love from the past?
Well, punk stuff, like, we're definitely fans of early punk, you know, 77.
Yeah.
I mean, 82, UK 82.2. But definitely, we get a lot from 70s punk bands.
Yeah,
I think we all love Misfits, honestly. Yeah. Like, that was kind of a weird thing that we clicked off in the beginning. We're
Sam Hain. They're LA based.
When they came here. Definitely.
Yeah. But we get a lot from 70s punk. Because when that wave of punk came out, or that, you know, the first wave of punk came out, like, everybody sounded different, you know. Blondie was punk, Ramones were punk, The Damned were punk, you know, all these first bands, like Talking Heads, you know, they were all the new wave of, like, music at the time, and, like, they all sounded different, you know. It wasn't until, like, later on that all those bands started, you know, getting pigeonholed into the spiky hair studs and stuff.
Right.
So we were really like that early stuff because their influences were, like, you know, T-Rex and glam and all that stuff. So
yeah, it was you know, and reading Please Kill Me and, like, learning about, like, the punk scene back then.
Yeah.
It was just, it was about having a place in a community, which is so much of what you guys are having now, and it was less about being, you're more rhythm guitar than a fast guitar. It was like, oh, you got keyboards. It was just, we all hung out at the same place and played music.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, you guys have your own monthly night, too, right? Which I guess you were saying came out of finding that something to do that was your own. How did you start your own night? Why do you want to start your own night? What's it called?
It's called Goth Night.
Beautiful. Love it.
Yeah, you know, simplicity. But nothing too fancy. Well, yeah, we did that because, yeah, we were tired of, like, the ska scene. And, you know, we love the punk scene and the metal scene and all that. But, you know, we wanted to do something our own, you know, something no one was doing, you know.
And so what's a Goth Night like?
Oh, it's pretty awesome.
It's like the blackest you'll ever see.
we got this.
It's just nothing but,
like, dress code. Like,
you
get a discount if you show up in all black.
Yeah.
And we haggle kids, like, if they have, like, you know, they come with, like, band shirts, like, with the white print. We're like, nope.
All black.
Just to fuck with them. Yeah, all black. No, but it's all fun.
We fuck with them, but it's cool.
Yeah, we only get like two or three bands. Because most of it is, like, to throw in that 80s goth club vibe, you know?
Yeah.
But for, like, a lot of kids that can't go to clubs, you know, or all that stuff, like, we bring it to the backyard scene.
I mean, the fact that it's all ages is pretty important to give access to people who are younger. Why do you guys like doing all-ages show? What do you get of a different vibe at those types of events? You
know, There's more of a rush because, you know, kids don't care. They just, you know, they do whatever they want.
I would say, like, when I was younger, too, it was more taboo.
And,
now it's like they kind of have that. I would have to say that the parents now are more lenient, so they're like, all right, it's nothing that bad.
Right.
80s bullshit. Like, a lot of them like that shit. So
right.
It's cool, you know? Like,
they're like, can I come?
Can I come hang out in the back?
They're like, oh, this is my music.
So, parents are the roadies, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool.
It's cool. They're supportive.
Surprisingly, there's some bands that have their parents as roadies.
Or managers.
Yeah.
They're looking out for them, making sure.
I feel like it's a good idea for kids who don't got that chance or can go. I mean, if you're gonna get fucked up responsibly, you know.
Well, it's interesting you say that because a lot of times punk is such a, like, a angry or, like, need a response to, like, a bad family life or, like, things are not good. But it seems like it's swung back where parents now can find a bond over the music that you guys are helping share with these kids.
Yeah, because a lot of the punks from, like, you know, the 80s or this, you know, the 90s or whatever, their parents were, like, what, baby boomers or something. You know, they came, you know. But now the kids from, you know, this generation, their parents were the punks or, you know, the rockers and stuff.
They
so they're
relate.
More accepting.
Yeah,
you know,
they can relate.
Yeah. They can relate because they went to shows of their own or things like that.
They know there's bad elements. Not if you, you know, embrace those elements, then you should be good.
Hmm. Awesome. Well, let's hear another song.
All right.
What are you guys going to play for us?
This next one is called it's called Belasco Tendency. It's a new one.
Awesome. Well, another new jam from the Pantheons at Dangerbird Record Studios.
Let's do it, guys.
Here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, yeah.
Let's do this.
Let's
rip
that shit up. We'll be right back.
Another heater. A real ripper.
Yeah,
it's
man.
It's a banger, man. Nothing but ragers.
Funnest one to play.
Now, you guys been playing out for a while. When did you decide that you wanted to start recording? How did that work? At what point do you start saying, we got enough songs that we want to, you know?
I think that's when, where you put it right now. Like, when people started noticing and started being like, hey, you guys are good. It's like, fuck, now we got to come out with a demo or something, like music to
yeah.
play here.
Well, because, I mean, how much of it, of this scene is live shows versus recording, or is it a mix? You know, it's like, you know, you're putting out a lot of songs on Bandcamp or, you know, digital platforms or 7 inches mm-hmm. versus playing as many shows as possible.
Well, I think playing shows comes
yeah,
first.
I think
yeah, because we haven't recorded in about a year. We're going to head back to the studio and do a new album. That should be due, I want to say late January, early February. But mostly live shows. You know, that's
yeah.
the main thing. We play almost every weekend.
Yeah.
You know, because mm-hmm. we love it, you know?
Let's talk about that first EP, Ballet of Gunfire. Mm-hmm. How did it come about? What was the process?
Oh, man, well, Paul, like, he shot me a bunch of ideas for song names, and that one was cool. I thought it was like, what did you... slap it on the EP, you know?
Yeah.
It's a good name. Like,
no,
it
was good.
Cool.
They were at that time, they were working at it together. I think it was just them
yeah.
two, because they were kind of having trouble with members. But like when I first heard the bass lines, he shot them to me, and I was like, wow, like I love it. Like,
so yeah.
It was, yeah, we started playing it, but mm-hmm. they were coming up with a lot of stuff.
So right now, we're not, well, yeah, like Paul said, we're going to go back and record. But yeah, those little things, I don't know if we'll come up with like EPs or little singles here and there throughout
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
We might, you know, we've done it before, but. Right now, I think we're just focused on trying to record the album.
Awesome. Now...
And shows.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know merch was such a big part of the punk scene. Is
yeah.
that big for you guys, like, doing the DIY shirts and everything like that, or is it...
Oh, definitely,
yeah.
Because yeah.
I mean,
I feel like now it's like that weird crossover with, like, Supreme and Limited Drops, and bands
mm-hmm.
now are doing, like, we're going to make 20 of these shirts, and you get them at the shows,
yeah.
and we'll make 20 different
yeah.
shirts.
Yeah.
yeah,
it's like they ride, you know, the waves of, like, certain aesthetics, and, you know, they go with it, especially, like... Yeah, with Supreme and all that stuff, and SoundCloud rappers, like, they have, like, a specific look, and they cash in on it.
Yeah.
And everybody cashes in on it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, for us, aesthetics is, like, super important. Well, for me, personally, when I make, like, the visuals, because, you know, I'm an art major, so, like, all the, you know, visuals just, I love them, you know? You know, color coordination, or, you know, art pieces that just look neat. I just look at album covers and, you know, just get ideas, just different stuff, you know?
I mean, I've always loved that about sort of the punk underground scene, is that it's all sort of one art voice, and there's just different ways to represent it, whether it's the music or the pins that
mm-hmm.
you guys make or the shirts that you make. How do you find the best way, like, what's the best ideal of representing your whole vibe?
Fuck, I guess. Pins right now. Don't get shirts.
We have some pins.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, don't forget, guys. Remember when we went to San Fran? We took stickers and shirts.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And we had our first gig. We were kind of nervous. We went on the road, and this guy told me, I literally joined the band like a month in, I think.
A month prior.
Yeah,
a month
yeah,
prior,
yeah.
And he told me, you want to go? And I wasn't with my band. We were kind of delaying, and we went over there, and they embraced us when we played. And what city
yeah,
was it?
Ventura.
Oh, Ventura.
Ventura, we played
yeah.
there, and it was embracing. Like, this is literally, like, we were in the room, we were playing. We played the first song, and I look up, and I see these guys all into it, and the room was packed, dude. Like, it was, like, everybody was dancing.
I mean, yeah,
was
that
so,
was, like, a year ago.
It was,
in comparison to, you know, 1 year ago, the scene is different than now.
Yeah.
But 1 year ago, like...
That was out,
like,
out of Compton, though.
Yeah, Compton was, like, you know, they didn't really care for our stuff.
We had to play out of the city.
Yeah.
We had to play out of the city because people didn't understand the music that we were trying to do.
And now,
definitely.
Oh, people have embraced you. What was the change? Like, when did you realize that the people, when they finally get it together like embrace you and understand what you were doing?
Well, actually, I like to think that they, I guess, all right, so like, because there's like this new wave of punk. And before, like a year, 2, 5 years ago, it was like the punk scene was like mostly dominant in like South Central and like downtown LA and stuff like that. But like now it's more leaning towards like North Long Beach. And like it's like a new wave of punks that kind of came on, and They dug it more than the old ones, but then the older heads, like, they're like, oh, well, okay, you know.
Well, the young kids like it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how fast, like, let's say I were to dip out of the scene for 3 or 4 months and then come back in. How different would it be? How fast is it changing? What's influencing that that rapid change?
It changes, you know, very...
I think that...
It's just, very volatile.
I think people got tired of it. Because it was... I think ska and punk has been so dominant in the area that people were just fed up with it. Because you go to shows and it's like sometimes it would just be our punker friends there and they're watching them. Like when I used to go to shows, I'm talking about a while ago, but we would just be watching it. And like, hey, what's happening this week? And oh, it's a ska show. We're like, oh, we'll just stay home.
Yeah.
It was the same old...
So you're like, oh, like you're just a ska band doing the ska sound that you saw the show.
Don't get me wrong. We have friends that play in ska bands, and we appreciate it. But it was just so dominant that it's kind of like, okay.
I think that if you leave for 3 months and come back, you probably wouldn't find anything right away. Mm-hmm. But there's always something going on.
Yeah. Dude, that's crazy. Yeah. So you got the new album coming out. Show every week. What do you guys see for the future of the band? What do you guys want to be doing?
Well, we don't see it. We always think everything like short term, you know. Like we don't think about that far ahead. We just, you know, what we do and today we do. We live in the now. Yeah, basically, you know, like make the best out of every day. So.
Like this is fucking awesome. I never done this before. Yeah. I would like
thanks
to do
for
this
coming.
Even
more.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
we appreciate it. We appreciate it a lot.
More too.
But like, yeah, we always think short term, you know, because like we don't like.
Like after this, we're gonna be like, what's next?
Yeah. We don't like that mentality. It's just like, oh, tomorrow, you know, so-and-so has a pin machine. Let's go make pins. All right. You know, just, you know, make a goal for, like, every week. Mm-hmm. We don't see everything, like, in a monthly or, like, yearly, you know, plan.
Then you
that we
task
do.
Yourself and then you get all crazy.
Exactly. Because then, you know, and the anticipation for it is, you know, leaves a lot of room for procrastination.
Yeah.
I hear that.
And, yeah.
Are there any other comparable scenes? I know you said San Francisco, but are there other scenes that you're across America that have the same sort of vibe that's going on in Compton, or is it just completely unique to what's happening?
I think there is. It's always there somewhere. Yeah.
I would say everywhere else, their own little scene, their own little backyard scene.
Yeah.
I saw a documentary in Mexico City, like, I think less than 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah?
And there's a big art scene happening right now, too. Like, it's not big, but it's kind of, it's still there, you know
there's
what
a,
I mean?
There's a punk scene in Pakistan.
I think everything is always around the world. It's just that it's not seen in the light. You know what I mean?
Yeah, LA will always get the spotlight because you know it has a history with punk.
Yeah.
You know, like places like I don't know, like
the Whiskey, Roxy. What?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
But like other states, like I don't know, whatever other state,
Oak
you know.
Dogs.
Florida or whatever, like, you know, they don't get, you know, because who do they have?
They had Less Than Jake, punk ska, yeah. Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Shout out to Kong, because Conger, the other guy on Sackington, he's an old Florida punk guy.
There he is.
I saw him coming.
You saw him coming in.
Tell him about Florida. He's got him right now.
Scratch that.
He's
Florida has Kong.
Florida's got Kong. They got some stories. Oh, yeah. He's got some stories about going to see NOFX and pickup trucks. And now with the internet, because like back in the day, like it was like writing letters, making phone calls, things like that. But with Instagram, things like that, it's got to be easier to like book shows, build a community, right?
It's like so fast paced. You can get like, especially if you have a good reputation, I think.
You gotta be a nice guy, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like the best way, because
you do good and good things will happen to you.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Awesome. And before we run out, because I want to make sure we get one more song, Omar, I know you own a restaurant.
Yeah.
Out in Compton, Alexander's World Famous Tortas.
Yep.
For those who've never been, what's the deal? What's the vibe? Because it got music. There's music there too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like all the guys eat there. Like
it's a rock and roll restaurant.
Everybody supports there. Yeah. I think the rock scene. The reason we did it too, because like you said, hip hop is so dominant in Compton.
Yeah.
So when we started doing that, everybody's like, "What the heck?" Like they would walk in, and you know the food's good. We tend to our customers. Our main thing is customer service.
Beautiful.
Besides the food being, you know,
food number one.
Yeah.
Equal customer service.
Exactly.
And good music.
And good music. We're always bumping. We even bump. We bump locals. We bump everything that's happening too. So we switch it out, and we're tending to the neighborhood. I would say.
It's cool to have a clubhouse with good food.
Yeah, heck yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty awesome. Much,
yeah.
You need vegan options.
Vegan options.
Yeah.
You can fry up some, jackfruit? I don't know. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was telling you.
And then Tuesdays. Tuesdays we have music open. So sometimes
live music.
Live music. Every other Tuesday some bands will come. But some of the guys work, but there's a lot of good bands that come out.
Yeah. Like after, you know, we punch out of work, like some guys just go and chill out at the restaurant and
play
jam out.
Songs. We give them some food and everybody's happy, and you know.
Dude, that's awesome. I love it. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming by. where can people find your music? Where can people find out about your shows?
You can find our stuff on Spotify, iTunes, every musical platform, YouTube, if you don't want to pay for that stuff. And you could check us out on Pantheon's Official on Instagram. And you could email us through there, too. Awesome. ThePantheonsMusic@gmail.com.
And what's the last song we're going to hear?
This last song is a more punkier one. It's called Benson and Hedges.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys. Thank you to Danger Bird. Thank you to everyone. One last song from Pantheons, then we'll see you next week on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Yeah.
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.